Good evening. Thanks for tuning in to the International Press Review. I'm your host, Jim Nelson. We're taping this program on Tuesday, February 6, 2024. The International Press Review reviews news from different regions of the world, giving listeners of this program a perspective of international news not often heard in the corporate mainstream media. The panelists for the program are Yukari Miyamai, Yukari reviews the Japanese press, Joe Yuhas, Joe reviews Eastern and Western European press, Ibrahim Kazrouni, Ibrahim reviews the Middle Eastern press, and Doug Vaughn, Doug covers news from Central and South America and the Caribbean basin. And we'll begin with news from Japan. And Yukari Miyamai. Go ahead, Yukari.
Thank you. So, glancing through the news from Japan for the last month, not very good. A victim of January earthquake are still not getting enough support from government. Delays in rescue mission had left many people buried in coldest weather. And details about damage on Shika nuclear power plant are still not forthcoming. And it is more than incompetence of Prime Minister Kishida's government. It looks like an intentional negligence. A scandal about the corruption inside the government and involvement of cult Unification Church influencing the election result is still ongoing. And Japanese parliament is deeply contaminated by continuous money flow from the cult. The most current news is about how the money from the cult is funding high-ranking official at the Ministry of Education, Culture, Sports, Science, and Technology, which is actually charged with prosecuting the cult. So numerous tentacles of the monstrous organization goes into the civic structure of democratic society in Japan. So there are not very much of good news of significance coming from Japan for a long time, but I am relieved to find something positive. So here is one. Japan's major trading company, ITOCHU, is a very big company. Its aviation unit will end its strategic cooperation with Israel defense company, Elbit System, by the end of this month. This come after the International Court of Justice ordered Israel to prevent act of genocide against Palestinians. This is rare, but big news in Japan. While many other weapon and defense-related industry are active in Japan against the peace constitution, this may signal some changes to come, hopefully. Ever since the end of World War II, Israel's interest has been represented and promoted in multiple areas of Japanese society, including religious theology, cultural appropriation of Palestinian art and music, and political propaganda in media and academics. While there are strong grassroots support for Palestinian cause in Japan, Israel's agenda has dominated Japanese mainstream culture and politics due to Japan-US relationship. For example, my childhood in 1950s, we were taught Israeli folk dance and songs in regular class during a primary school education. Of course, later we found out those folk dances we learned are traditional Palestinian dances. During my middle school And high school years, we were taught about the kibbutz system and socialism. However, we are not taught about its connection to colonialism and settler land grab of Nakba. And we learn about the brutality of Israel against the Palestinian people through actually an armed rebellion of Japanese Red Army. I don't know if you ever heard of them. And since 1972 through 1974, 97, 1979, this group were active in the Middle East. Many years later, we heard about arrest of Husako Shigenobu in 2000. Shigenobu was a high-level commander of Japanese Red Army. She was released from prison in May 2022 after fulfilling the full term of sentence. So Japanese Red Army was designated as a terrorist group. And its activity and hideout route span from Israel, Lebanon, Malaysia, Romania, Peru, and Bolivia. And I think there are at least 7 members of the group still on the run. 1 week ago, on January 30th, Japanese government has announced that and implemented a new policy to punish and freeze assets of 2 individuals and 4 organizations that supported Palestinian cause, accusing them of financially supporting Hamas. I don't know where this particular event is moving, but I just want you to know, the listener to know that Japanese society is quite involved in this conflict between Israel and Palestine. Okay, so going to the next topic, Japan's domestic condition and international diplomatic position continue to be eroding. Especially prominent decline are visible in social justice, social welfare, healthcare system and education. National budget for primary education in Japan has been drastically cut down, less than half compared to 20 years ago, while reduced birth rate has been only about 5%. Even 10 years ago, Japan ranked lowest in educational budget among OECD countries in GDP ratio. If you compare the nutritional quality and the volume of serving for school lunch among the neighboring countries, Japanese school lunch looks embarrassingly meager. Budget for last year was the lowest, down to 1 trillion yen, which is less than $15 billion. In contrast, China allocates 15.5% of national budget to education, while defense budget takes up about 5.7%. And just for the comparison, USA allocates only 3% of national budget for education, while defense budget takes up 13%. I am sure this number too low, but this is what I have gained. Okay, another topic. World Bank Russia office has recently revealed that Japan has been assigned as a guarantor for Ukraine to cover and pay off the entire loss, including interest, to International Bank of Reconstruction and Development, if or when Ukraine defaulted on the loan. This arrangement seems to come as a surprise to Japanese people. At least that is how it has been reported in media. We never knew that was going on. Let's see, just currently, Zelensky has requested additional 5 million euro per year for four more years on top of 50 billion euro assistance, just approved by EU. So Japan may be dragged into this financial arrangement in a very negative way. That is what I have for now. Thank you.
Thanks, Shikari.
I have a question, if there's time, Jim.
Yes.
Yukari, the Japanese Red Army, this kind of 1970s phenomenon, did it have in it any sizable number of immigrants from Korea? Or was it like 100% Japanese?
Those people that we know that have been involved in this very militant activity were all Japanese people and very highly educated people at the time. And then one particular person actually hijacked the airplane and went into North Korea. And he became a North Korean
Oh,
citizen.
so that's what was in my head. I had something in my head about connection to North Korea, with the Japanese Red Army. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. That was Yukari Miyamai covering the Japanese press. Now we move on to Ibrahim Kazrouni, and Ibrahim covers the Middle Eastern press. Go ahead, Ibrahim.
Yes, good evening to my colleague. Good evening to you, Jim, and to our listeners. There is a mixed bag of news coming out of the Middle East, although there is a central theme that runs through it. But we have seen activities of various foreign ministers from Europe, as well as Americans going to Lebanon, trying to subdue the Hezbollah movement in the north and see whether there can be reached some kind of agreement between them and the Israeli government so that the situation would not go out of control. But we get to it in a minute. Iran is entering into the 45th year of its revolution, an anniversary of its revolution in 1978-79. And most of the spaces given in various newspapers focuses on the revolution itself and the reaction or consequence of that revolution in a regional as well as global political kind of dynamics, particularly the relationship with the United States, so extensively written. A recent article, or at least push by the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and calling to attack Iran before Iran's Pearl Harbor moment, which is similar to what the media was talking about relationship with Iraq, and we should attack Saddam before the mushroom cloud comes to New York. We see that similar kind of narratives being used by a number of neocons, specifically people like Bolton, Lindsey Graham, Nikki Haley, AIPAC, and others. Some of the Persian newspapers have given space to these, but dismissed them as marginal and literally burned out politicians, that their shelf life are over, and they are trying to reinvigorate something that the United States cannot do anything about it. U.S. doesn't seem to understand that repeating the failed military strategy in trying to subdue people in Iraq, Syria, and other places in Yemen will not work because it has failed in the past, and it will do nothing more than bind and force these groups to unite together, as it happened after the recent bombings by the Americans and the Iraqi, Syrians, and Yemenis, and Lebanese resistance movement are uniting, coming together and stating that so long as they are being attacked or a member of the resistance axis is being attacked, it's an attack on all of them, and they all would respond. So we are moving into really, how can I put this, a heated and volatile situation in the Middle East. And some people are reporting that the U.S. is searching or seeking some kind of a way out of Iraq and Syria. And Blinken's visit to the area to find out if it is possible to come to a solution in which it will be a face-saving exercise for the Israelis, but at the same time, some kind of agreement will be reached, not only with Hamas, with the Palestinians, and with other axes of resistance, because at the moment, everybody has said no discussion, no debate, nothing until the Gaza situation is resolved. Hamas yesterday sent forward their answer to the peace proposal that through Qatar, Egypt was put to them, and the Qatari foreign minister indicated that they have received a response from Qatar, and they are studying it and putting it to the US as well as the Israelis to see whether that could become the basis for moving forward and a final resolution of a complete release of Palestinian prisoners, for a complete release of the Israeli prisoners in Hamas's hand can be achieved. The only stumbling block is whether it should be done at the moment before a complete cessation of violence and withdrawal of Israelis from Gaza, as Hamas and the Palestinians are asking for, or it should be within some kind of a short period after, where the Israelis say, no, we should resolve the issue of the prisoners, and then we stop. Hamas is not prepared to give the Israelis any advantage to claim that they have been successful in the military exercise. The fact that they have not been able to achieve any of the high goals that they, or aspiration that they had at the beginning, complete annihilation of Hamas, complete destruction of this, complete destruction of that, as it happened in 2006, which I remember I said, I draw the similarity between the two, and I said, the goals are too high, and like 2006, they are not going to achieve this goal, and they have to climb down. We are beginning to see that the Israelis not only thinking of climbing down and asking for ignoring the Hamas and everything else, because you cannot get rid of them. Military leaders within Israel, they are asking for a commission similar to Vinograd commission that organized after 2006 war, which concluded that the high command bungled the war and the need for them to pay back for their failure. The Israelis now are calling for the same thing. We need some kind of commission to account for the bundled way of dealing with what happened in Gaza, and the current leadership to pay for the price of what the failure that they had. Recently, an article published by Wall Street Journal under the title of "Welcome to Dearborn, America's Jihadist Capital." This was considered to be extremely, extremely volatile by the Muslim community and disrespectful. And as we were discussing earlier, it was considered to be anti-Semitic in the sense that as anti-Muslim sentiment, Islamophobia, and the Muslim community here, they have organized themselves By the way, Biden sent a message to the Muslim community here that he wanted to come and visit Dearborn and Dearborn Heights and talk to the Muslim leaders, and they all rejected him. They said under no way they will come and communicate. And there is an active group now in Dearborn and Dearborn Heights and other places within the Muslim community to work hard not to allow Muslims to vote for Biden or any of the associate of Biden if they were to be put forward by the Democratic Party. So this year, because of the stance of Biden against genocide of Palestinians and the indifference of Biden against genocide of Palestinians and refusal to put pressure on the Israelis to accept ceasefire and end it, similar to what happened in 2006, where Condoleezza Rice was conducting the affairs and going around, has led the Muslim community, mayors and religious leaders, political leaders, activists, to say no more. They are not going to vote for Biden or the Democratic Party because they are, at the end of the day, supporting the same kind of policy vis-à-vis the Palestinians. The Syria is another issue that has come up, not only because of the bombing of US on the northeast of Syria. Syria is becoming the darling of the Middle East in a sense that all countries that in 2010 were calling for the destruction of Syrian regime now find themselves with no other option to accept that Bashar al-Assad is here to stay, and they have to recognize that, particularly after granting him the seat of the Syrian seat at the Arab summit. Now you're beginning to see more and more ambassadors going from countries that up to 5 years ago they had already washed their hands of Syria and Bashar al-Assad. The connection recently, a detailed analysis of the connection between Western charities and IDF, and how Western charities, under the cloak of charitable organization, they are supporting Gaza genocide and supporting IDF and agreeing with the Israeli government. So this, particularly in United Kingdom, United States, have been researched and written about. These are some of the points that covers the Middle Eastern paper. We have to wait and see. There is an incoming meeting planned for the Russian, the Turks, the Iranian to get together and see whether we can find a solution for the Turks to recognize the total sovereignty of the Syrian government, even on Idlib, giving the Syrian government an excuse, or at least the green light, that now they can push for clearing up the Idlib terrorist centers and then focusing on the eastern section, which is primarily the American control. But after the recent bombing, while we have seen that everybody is have said the same thing, that they are going to continue the attacking the US bases in the Middle East. And because of the crisis, Iraqi government prime minister has communicated with the Americans that they need a speedy resolution and withdrawal of the Americans from Iraqi bases completely, and no more American soldiers in Iraq. So we'll see what happens.
Well, thank you. Go ahead.
I have a question also to Ibrahim, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
I've read recently, I think it was in the Financial Times, that Saudi Arabia is getting armaments from South Korea. Have you heard anything about this? And if yes, do you attach any importance to it?
I have heard, Joe, that they are turning towards East in general. A lot of the contracts have been signed with China in exchange of military technology. They give them oil and gas, which the Chinese desperately need. I wouldn't be surprised. I have not seen specifically about South Korea, but about Chinese. It seems that Mohammed bin Salman gradually is moving away from total and absolute reliance on the American military hardware. Last year, they bought a huge amount of armament from Russia. And now they are moving towards China. I wouldn't be surprised if South Korean would be part of that move. But certainly there is a clear move by Mohammed bin Salman away from absolute reliance on American and Western in general, but American specific armament. And I don't know whether details have not been released, but certainly a huge amount of money is involved. But what I have heard that these billions of dollars that they would purchase from China, they will sell them oil in return rather than give them cash.
Thank you very much.
That's
exactly what I was thinking. And, you know, there's tremendous significance to the Saudis sort of moving towards the middle instead of being clearly allied with, quote unquote, the West. I mean, they're no small potatoes in the world, the money market.
By the way, Joe, Yemenis are moving, making sounds going towards the Chinese and asking the Chinese to provide them with the weapons that they want, or at least military technology. Some of the missiles that they are using is a carbon copy of the Chinese missiles that now in their they're using similar techniques to reverse engineering and copying them and developing it in their own armament.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, that was Ibrahim Kazrouni giving us an update on Middle Eastern news. And now we move on to Kyo Yuhas and Western and Eastern European news. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, good evening, colleagues, and Jim. Jim, still wonderful to see you back in full health. And jó estét kívánok, kedves hallgatóim. Well, I am going to begin at a certain word and see how far I get with it. The word is heirloom. And I am going to begin with heirloom tomatoes.
They are tasty, Joe.
That's precisely the point. And what else are they besides tasty? They're more nutritious than the hybrids and the modern tomatoes. Far more nutritious. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're far more expensive also. Now let's talk about 5 million years of human history. The heirloom tomato is the one that has not been improved by progress. Right? And let's say not merely in America, but pretty much everywhere in the world, there were and there are to this day agricultural universities that are developing newer and newer strains of tomato, only to discover that they don't taste as good and they're not as nutritious as the original. So I'm going to jump from heirloom tomatoes to Europe, and let's see if anybody besides me can make sense of the jump I am about to make. In a certain way, what could a person could say, and at least make an argument for the following statement. Modern European history begins with the defeat of Napoleon in Russia. And to this day, no one in Western Europe can come to terms with the reality that the backward, quote unquote, Russians were able to defeat the most advanced country in the world, France. This is an instance where guerrilla warfare defeats modern development. And it is like the heirloom tomato, a tomato in the face of a certain version of history, which goes like this. The Stone Age tools are defeated by copper. Copper is defeated by iron. Iron is defeated by steel. Steel is defeated by tungsten or whatever it is. The notion that there is a kind of linear progress that's associated with technological development, whether we're talking about agricultural technology or military technology or any other technology. So in a certain sense, the defeat of Napoleon is in some way a progenitor of the heirloom tomato. Now we can jump back a good, 40 years or so before Napoleon, for that matter, and we can say that American history begins with the quote-unquote Revolutionary War, which we are taught from the third grade on, was a case of guerrilla warfare against an advanced European military empire. That the Green Mountain Boys, etc., etc., knew the lay of the land, da 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 da, and the British didn't. And essentially, Washington waged a successful guerrilla war against the British. I'm now going to jump forward to the period both Yukari and Ibrahim were talking about, the 1970s. This is something we could spend a lot of time about. This is when America gets defeated in Vietnam. Literally, not figuratively. We have in Vietnam a successful war of national liberation, which is a guerrilla army fighting the most advanced technology in the world and defeating it. Boy, those heirloom tomatoes were sure a lot better than the hybrids from the Home Economics Department at the University of California at Davis, weren't they? Now we can sort of advance forward into contemporary history from modern history and talk about the war in Ukraine, which now we're actually at the present moment on the continent of Europe. The Ukrainian war was sold to the public with the following two ideas more than any other. One, it's a struggle of Western democratic liberalism against the primitive Russian centralized authoritarian Putinism, and we can only win. There is no other alternative. We have now turned the book back on Hitler and his unsuccessful attempt to do better than Napoleon, and we will defeat the Russians once and for all. Much of the Western press at a point, what was it, maybe about a year ago, said that the war was already over. We had defeated the Russians. I don't think Joe Juhas quite said that back a year ago, and he was considered a complete outside thinker. The other way it was sold is very intriguing, that it is in fact going to be a guerrilla warfare of the Ukrainian people against the Russian invader. You may have noticed, or maybe you have not, that there has not been one guerrilla action in the parts of the Ukraine which the Russians have more or less annexed. A complete misjudgment, an inability to understand history in any other terms than the inevitable glorious victory of progress over quote unquote primitivism. And now comes something inexplicable, where have perhaps Ibrahim and or anybody else on the panel can help me. We have in the history of the contemporary world the catastrophic defeat of the Americans in Iraq by guerrilla warfare against them. We have the catastrophic defeat in Afghanistan, first of the Russians and then of the Americans. We have, I can go on and on and on, but we don't see the same guerrilla tactics on the part of the Palestinians, either in Gaza or the West Bank, which were successful against Napoleon, against Hitler, against the British, against the Americans, da 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 da. I am at a loss, and the people whom I am reading, who are saying similar things that overlap with what I am saying, where is there in Gaza that 9-year-old girl who'll take a Coca-Cola bottle, 8 ounces of petrol, and a wick, put a match to it, and destroy a $20 million Israeli tank? I don't see it. I don't see it. Any thoughts by anybody? Thoughts, reactions, questions?
Dog, you want to go?
No, it would require a lengthy disquisition rather than a short question and answer.
I think the situation,
the
Joe,
terrain
the situation
and technology are very different than Vietnam, let alone the steppes of Russia. And guerrilla warfare in an urban setting like Gaza is very different than a rural setting like the Mekong Delta of Vietnam, let alone the marshes outside of Leningrad.
Excellent observation. Anybody else?
I have.
Go
ahead, Ibrahim.
Go ahead, Yukari. Go.
Well, my observation, which you know, I follow quite a bit of Hamas spokesperson presentation or whatever, seems like the furious attack in a very condensed area seems to be, it's impossible to have that kind of a guerrilla war. But according to what I'm reading, Israeli military haven't been able to actually have this so-called tunnel. Even they don't know exactly how much of the tunnel is destroyed because there were lots of decoy. So in terms of resistance, people seems to have more knowledge. We may not hear it on our mainstream media, but in terms of the so-called guerrilla war, I don't know if we can dismiss the way that Joe, you are actually describing. I don't know if we have enough information coming out.
That's so very helpful. Anybody else?
Yes, Joe, you see, your question to a degree rests on the assumption that there is only one style of guerrilla warfare. The classic style of pouring a little bit of gas in a bottle and putting something on it, letting it light, and throwing it against somebody else. The strategy, guerrilla warfare, changes. In the same manner that Yukari was talking about hijacking a plane, I would consider all of these are part of guerrilla warfare. The fact that a group of people such as Gazan, that the Israelis had dismissed them, unable, incapable, and not even intelligent enough to be able to mount an attack on Israeli soldiers or Israeli position, and even to go over these electronic walls, to go into periphery of Gaza, I would consider that a type of guerrilla warfare. Guerrilla warfare is literally the war between asymmetrical group, where you have a dominant force on one side and very little force on the other, that little force has to be structured and organized in a manner that would product, would the Yasin 105 is a replica of that bottle that you used to see it during the Second World War. Yasin 105 military kind of projectile that cost only $3,000 in front of Merkava that cost millions of dollars does the same thing. So as Doug said, it requires a detailed analysis of the situation, but the expectation that there is only one style of guerrilla warfare, not to distinguish between, say, guerrilla warfare in jungles and other places and in cities with narrow streets, et cetera, I think that requires a little bit of adjustment.
Also very helpful. I think at this point we've used up my time, and Jim, let's move forward.
Thank you, Joe. That was Joe Juhas covering the Western and Eastern European press. And now we go on to Doug Vaughn. Doug will be covering Central and South America as well as the Caribbean Basin region. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay, thank you. Hello to my colleagues as well as bienvenidos al público en general. I would talk a little bit about elections, talk a little bit about political repercussions, foreign policy, and dueling forms of dollarization. The recently elected, self-described anarcho-capitalist Milei in Argentina has decided to go on his first big tour of Europe. And this is already causing quite a big stir, not only in Argentina, where he took office in mid-December after a fairly large margin of victory in the presidential elections in the runoff in November, but also regionally, and even with some commentary in Europe about what this portends. Milei is considered a kind of a new wave. He calls himself occasionally an anarchist. Other times he says he's a libertarian. But if there's a real antecedent to his economic program and policies, it's probably the monetarist school of economics that was championed by Milton Friedman in the late 20th century and came to be associated in Latin America with the so-called Chicago School of Economics. Friedman had taught for many years at the University University of Chicago. And his conservative brand of monetary policy was pushed very far and very hard throughout the 1980s, especially by Ronald Reagan and subsequently by his successor, George Bush, but also became the basis for the so-called Washington Consensus after the collapse or fall, implosion, if you will, of the Soviet Union, which removed the then leading alternative model to a globalized capitalist economy on a world scale. And that program in Latin America was implemented very fiercely by the military dictatorship of Pinochet in Chile after the military overthrow of the socialist government of Allende in 1973. The Chicago School, the so-called Chicago Boys, who were hired as advisors in Chile, spread their doctrine throughout Latin America in close association with the Catholic Church, which rejected under Pope John Paul II, the Polish Pope, Paul Wojtyla, the idea of a national liberation or liberation theology that would lead people towards socialism. Milei's economic program basically revolves on trying to convert Argentina's combination of social welfare programs in association with organized labor into a Chilean-style austerity program imposed not by freeing the economy to negotiations between equal partners under a libertarian program, but rather the imposition of austerity in the form of privatization of nationally owned, publicly owned railways, transportation systems, public power generators, and so on, but also a direct attack on unions. And this has resulted in not only serious resistance in the streets, to which Malay has responded with fierce denunciations about unions, trade unions, as being terrorists for having rejected his program, but also the legislature, where Malay's party holds a mere 38 out of some 267, I believe, seats in the House of Deputies. And so this rejection has resulted in a paralysis of his government, because the proposed so-called reforms that he says will liberate capital from the bonds of labor and the state has, in fact, so far generated not only resistance but condemnation by the legislature and by the unions, which represent a significant, probably 50% of the labor force. And those who are not so well employed in trade unions are facing fierce inflation, which Malay promised to control by dollarizing the economy. Well, what does dollarizing the economy mean in a place like Argentina, which has its own currency? It means that those who are paid in dollars or can gain dollars because of their control over exports, which are traded in dollars, which the exporters receive from foreign markets, would have a very great advantage. And this advantage includes the ability to hoard goods that are purchased with dollars in order to be able to raise the prices for sale of those commodities on the black market. What's interesting about Malay's being celebrated in the Western press, meaning the mainstream press in the United States and in Europe, not so much in Latin America, is that his program is not only stalled, but has ignited exactly the kind of reaction that Pinochet's did, except that Pinochet, of course, ran a military dictatorship and murdered several thousand people in order to enforce that kind of austerity. So it's interesting to note that in his first trip abroad, the two places that are so far on the itinerary are Italy and Israel. Malay has actually denounced Pope Francis, his fellow Argentine, as being a socialist. And he's described his neighboring country, Brazil, which has a very mixed economy and a resurgent left, as being communist, which it is not. And at the same time, he said that he's considering converting from Catholicism to Judaism, and therefore is seeking a special relationship with Israel at precisely the point where Israel is regarded as a pariah by most of the so-called civilized world. I will have to leave it there since my time is short, but I will note that a similar program of dollarization, at least in terms of the easy convertibility of foreign so-called hard currencies like the dollar into the local currency, was undertaken in none other than socialist Cuba in the 1990s. In response to the blockade, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which resulted in a quadrupling of prices for imports from the former Soviet bloc, and a renewed dependency on Western Europe, and especially the United States, which of course had been exercising a now 60-year-old embargo on most production coming out of Cuba. Cuba, too, has recently announced austerity measures in response to its ongoing economic crisis. And this will require some additional discussion in the coming weeks, but it's very much in line with the so-called dollarization program, which sought to encourage foreign investment or at least repatriation of dollars from Cuban exiles, principally in the United States, in order to develop the local economy. I'll leave it there for now since my time is up.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And that was Doug Vaughn covering Central and South America as well as the Caribbean Basin region. Well, that's all the time we have for this evening's program. I would like to thank our roundtable panel for another fine job. And as always, the panelists are Yukari Miyamai, Joe Yuhas, Doug Vaughn, and Ibrahim Kazrouni. I've been your host, Jim Nelson. Tune in next month for another edition of the International Press Review.